So if you're listening to this while you're out on a walk right now, taking steps through your neighborhood, I want you to just take a second and look around.
Yeah, look at the physical space you're in, the
Yeah.
sidewalks, the curbs, the width of the streets.
Exactly. Look at the driveways cutting across your path because you are actively navigating a physical world that has been meticulously built around a very specific, incredibly rigid set of mobility assumptions.
Right, assumptions about exactly who is doing the moving, how they are moving, and, the physical capabilities they inherently possess while navigating that space.
Yeah, we've basically built an entire civilization around this template of a highly capable, unimpaired, average-sized adult human.
We really have.
Yeah.
And anyone outside that narrow template just has to figure it out.
Okay, let's unpack this because today we are taking a deep dive into what happens when every single one of those foundational assumptions gets completely inverted.
Which is such an exciting shift.
It really is. We are looking at the massive paradigm shift of autonomous vehicles and public transport. But I want to be clear right out of the gate here. We are not just talking about the shiny sci-fi aesthetics of a car driving itself.
No, not at all. That's just the surface level.
Right. We are exploring how removing the human driver forces a ground-up rethink of the physical engineering of our vehicles, the wildly complex software that runs them, and the very nature of how we conceptualize long-distance travel.
It's a fundamental reimagining of mobility from the chassis up, honestly. Because for the longest time, the automotive industry has essentially operated on a model of exclusion by default.
Exclusion by default, that's a great way to put it.
Yeah, I mean, you build for that theoretical average user, and everyone else who falls outside of that strict bell curve simply have to adapt. Or they have to pay exorbitant fees to modify the product. Or, sadly, they just get excluded entirely.
And to guide us through how we fix that, we're pulling insights from a really diverse stack of research today.
We have some incredibly rich sources for this deep dive.
We do. We've got data from the University of Toronto's Transportation Research Institute, design frameworks from the Centre for Universal Design Australia, and some heavy-hitting analysis from ITIS America on driverless fleets.
And we are also going to weave in a fascinating Arkansas University study on how autonomous vehicles rewrite the psychology of long-distance travel.
Oh, that part is wild. And we also have a really granular finished thesis on the blind spots in regional transport planning. So the core mission here is to figure out how this autonomous future can be designed for everyone right from the start, rather than just being retrofitted as an afterthought.
That word right there, retrofitted, is truly the mechanical and philosophical bottleneck of our current transportation system.
It really is the trap we're stuck in.
Completely. To understand where autonomous mobility needs to go, we first have to rigorously examine how we design things right now. Currently, when it comes to inclusive design, our standard operating procedure relies heavily on compliance frameworks.
Right, like ADA compliance, the Americans with Disabilities Act, which, let's acknowledge, completely changed the landscape of access. I mean, it is foundational.
Oh, absolutely. It is a vital, historically significant legal framework. But from a pure engineering and design perspective, ADA compliance operates as a legal floor, not a ceiling.
That makes sense. It's the bare minimum required by law.
Exactly. It is treated as a checklist. A manufacturer builds the standard exclusionary product and then alters it just enough to avoid legal penalty.
Wow, yeah, that is exactly how it feels.
But the framework provided by our sources at the Center for Universal Design Australia emphasizes that universal design operates on a completely different axis.
How so?
Well, it's an inclusive philosophy that expands the design parameters from day one to naturally accommodate the broadest possible spectrum of human variation.
I love that. It's the difference between designing a beautiful building and then bolting an ugly aluminum ramp to the side of it versus designing a building where the primary entrance is just a seamlessly graded, elegant incline that everyone uses.
That is the perfect analogy.
And what really struck me in the ITS America research is this concept of situational or conditional impairment. Because I think when people hear accessible design, they immediately default to thinking only of permanent severe physical limitations.
And that is a massive misconception that honestly holds back industrial design. Conditional impairment is a universal human experience. It affects virtually everyone.
Exactly, like you sprain your ankle on a ski trip.
Right, or you are an aging adult who just wants to age in place in your own neighborhood, but your balance isn't quite what it used to be.
Yeah, or you're a parent trying to wrangle a massive double stroller onto a city bus. Or honestly, you're just a traveler dragging 50 pounds of awkward luggage through a transit hub while trying to check your phone.
Yes. Universal design fundamentally improves the physics of the environment for all of those scenarios.
It's so true.
If you engineer a sidewalk with a gently sloping curb cut instead of a harsh 6-inch vertical drop, yes, it accommodates a wheelchair user flawlessly. But the person with the rolling luggage benefits too.
Oh, absolutely. The delivery worker with a hand truck benefits.
Exactly. When you design for the margins of human capability, you actually optimize the core experience for the center.
Which brings us to the automotive industry, a sector not exactly famous for designing for the margin.
True. But there is a phenomenal case study in our sources about Toyota that challenges that.
Yes. Back in the 2000s over in Japan, they pioneered this exact approach with two specific models, the Ralum and the Porte. And they didn't just guess at what people needed. They built this thing called an Ergo Index.
The Ergo Index was a triumph of quantitative design. Toyota didn't just build a prototype and ask a focus group if they liked it.
They got really scientific with it, right?
They did. They created a rigorous scoring system evaluating 180 different interactive touch points across 6 specific areas of the vehicle. And they scored these touch points entirely based on human ergonomics and extreme physical variance.
Meaning they were mathematically mapping out how a 4'10" elderly woman and a 6'4" athlete would physically interact with the exact same door handle.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The same door handle, the same seat depth, the same sight lines.
And the result of all that data crunching was the Toyota Port. What I really love about this is they never marketed it as a specialized medical vehicle. They pitched it as a lifestyle car for everyone.
What's fascinating here is the mechanical choices on the Port are a masterclass in challenging automotive orthodoxy. First, they opted for a tall hatchback design, which completely neutralizes headroom constraints during ingress and egress.
Nobody has to duck or fold themselves in half to get in.
Right. Second, they utilized a massive power sliding door on the pavement side, similar to what you'd see on a large minivan, but they engineered it onto a highly compact urban footprint.
And the floor. We have to talk about the floor.
Yes, the floor is brilliant.
They completely eliminated the transmission tunnel. The floor of the car was perfectly flat, meaning the driver could literally slide across the front bench and exit out of the passenger side sliding door if they were parked in a tight spot.
Or if there was heavy traffic zipping by on the driver's side. It just gives you options.
But the absolute crown jewel of this engineering, the feature that actually made me stop reading and look up a video of it on my phone, was the auto access seat.
Well, the auto access seat is mechanical choreography at its finest. It replaces the standard front passenger seat, but it is mounted on a complex motorized rail system.
It looks like something from a spaceship.
It does. At the activation of a switch, the entire seat swivels 90 degrees to face out the open sliding door. It then pitches slightly forward, and the motorized rails extend the entire seat out of the vehicle cabin and lower it toward the pavement.
It mechanically lowers itself to the exact transfer height of a standard wheelchair.
Exactly.
So if you are transitioning from a chair, or if you're someone who just lacks the leg strength to step up into a cabin, the vehicle comes to you. You sit down and the car seamlessly lifts you back up, retracts into the cabin, and locks into place.
What's vital to understand here is the stark contrast between that level of foundational integrated engineering and the way the broader auto industry normally functions.
Right. And this is where I start to get a little frustrated, because if I look at my office, I have a height adjustable standing desk. I bought one piece of furniture, and it perfectly serves my physical needs, whether I'm sitting down or if a colleague who's a foot taller than me wants to use it, standing up.
The mechanics of the desk just adapt to the human.
Right. If we have the engineering capability, as Toyota proved 20 years ago, why on earth does the auto industry still treat universal design as this niche aftermarket problem? Why isn't a flat floor and a swivel seat the foundational blueprint for every single sedan rolling off the line?
It essentially comes down to the brutal realities of hardware manufacturing, combined with an incredibly rigid regulatory environment.
Okay, tell me more about that.
Well, if you look at the software industry, iteration is fluid. If an app's user interface isn't accessible, engineers can write a patch and push an update globally by Tuesday. Hardware, particularly automotive hardware, is relentlessly static.
Yeah, I mean, you can't exactly download a software patch to lower the physical floor of your Honda Civic.
Exactly. The automotive industry operates on economies of scale, utilizing highly specialized billion-dollar platform architectures. Once a vehicle's chassis and drivetrain are finalized, altering the physical structure is profoundly difficult and expensive.
Because it's literally stamped steel.
Yes. Furthermore, vehicle design is heavily constrained by federal crash test requirements. The structural pillars, the seat anchor points, the airbag trajectories, they are all optimized for standard forward-facing seating.
I see.
So radically changing the interior layout risks failing those rigid compliance tests.
So the manufacturers essentially build a standardized, heavily fortified steel box. And if your specific physical body doesn't effortlessly fit into that box, it is entirely your personal and financial problem to figure out how to modify it after you've bought it.
That is the traditional model, yes. And it leads us directly into what transportation planners call the retrofitting trap.
And the retrofitting trap is where the friction of our current system becomes mathematically terrifying. I mean, the ITS America report details the staggering pent-up demand for accessible ride-sharing.
The numbers are huge.
We aren't talking about a small niche. We are talking about 15.4 million travel-limited households in the U.S. alone, over 6 million wheelchair users.
And as the models project, just to satisfy the future demand for ride-sharing fleets, Uber, Lyft, and eventual autonomous fleets, there will be a requirement for over 2 million accessible vehicles.
But because the auto industry isn't out there building 2 million Toyota ports, we are attempting to serve that massive demand by hacking apart standard factory cars.
It is a financial and structural nightmare.
Walk us through what an aftermarket retrofit actually entails, because it's not just swapping out a seat, is it?
Far from it. Let's say you purchase a standard factory minivan. To make it wheelchair accessible, a third-party conversion company have to essentially perform major surgery on the vehicle.
Wow, major surgery.
Literally, they cut out the factory floor, they reroute the exhaust systems, the brake lines, and sometimes the fuel tank to physically drop the floor level enough to accommodate the height of a passenger sitting in a wheelchair.
Just to get the necessary headroom inside.
Right. Then they have to reinforce the compromised frame with heavy steel plating and install a mechanized ramp. The aftermarket cost for this modification alone can approach $60,000.
Wait, $60,000? So you are paying the base price of a brand new car plus another $60,000 just to legally and safely get inside of it?
Yes. It's an immense financial burden.
Yeah.
And structurally, you are taking a chassis that was mathematically engineered by the manufacturer to handle a specific payload and stress distribution, and you are fundamentally altering its center of gravity and rigidity.
It's like undermining the foundation of a house.
Exactly. Furthermore, there's a massive evolutionary mismatch happening. The medical device industry, which designs wheelchairs, is innovating rapidly.
Oh, I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah, wheelchairs are getting highly customized. They are incorporating larger battery packs, complex suspension systems, and because of that, they're getting wider and heavier.
But the door opening and the ramp width of a 2018 retrofitted minivan are static. They never change.
Precisely. So you have a situation where a user gets a new state-of-the-art wheelchair every 5 years, and suddenly they literally cannot fit through the door frame of their $80,000 retrofitted van anymore.
That is infuriating. It creates an unbreakable bottleneck. And when municipalities try to force this retrofitting model at an industrial scale to solve public transit issues, you see catastrophic failures in execution.
You really do.
The most glaring example in our sources is the New York City Taxi of Tomorrow initiative.
Oh, this case study is so revealing.
This story is wild. So New York City decides it's time to retire the iconic Ford Crown Victoria taxis. They want a purpose-built modern taxi of tomorrow. They run a massive global competition, and they end up selecting the Nissan NV200, which is basically a compact, boxy commercial van.
The intentions behind the initiative were definitely sound. The city wanted better fuel efficiency, updated safety features, and a unified fleet that could theoretically offer better accessibility.
Right. Sounds great on paper.
But the mechanical reality of retrofitting the NV200 to accommodate wheelchairs was deeply flawed.
Flawed is a very generous word. First of all, the massive additional weight of the wheelchair retrofitting the heavy steel ramps, the lowered and reinforced floors, fundamentally altered the vehicle's physics.
It stressed the hardware in ways it wasn't designed for.
Exactly. The original NV200 chassis and suspension were never engineered to carry that specific, constant, localized weight distribution. As a result, these taxis were wearing down their rear tires unusually fast. The vehicles were essentially eating themselves because the hardware was fighting its own design.
It's a classic engineering conflict.
But honestly, the tire issue pales in comparison to the human experience of using these things.
The most alarming design failure was the point of ingress and egress. Because of the vehicle's dimensions and the retrofitment constraints, wheelchair users were forced to enter and exit the taxi from the rear of the vehicle through the back cargo doors.
Let's just visualize this for a second, okay? You are in Midtown Manhattan. It is rush hour, cars are honking, maybe it's raining. The taxi pulls over to the curb. Instead of sliding into the side door directly from the safety of the sidewalk, the driver has to get out, walk around to the back of the van, open the rear cargo doors, and deploy a ramp.
Which puts the passenger in a terrible position.
Which means the passenger has to roll their wheelchair off the sidewalk, out into the active street, directly into the flow of trailing traffic, just to get up the ramp and into the cab. It is an absolute failure of both imagination and basic human safety.
It highlights a massive and persistent regulatory gap. Historically, taxi fleets have operated under certain exemptions regarding ADA wheelchair accessibility rules.
Which is just bizarre when you think about public transit.
It is. But because they weren't forced to build accessibility into the DNA of the fleet from day one, we end up with this fragmented system. If you require a wheelchair in New York, the wait time to dispatch one of the few retrofitted rear-entry NV200s is vastly longer than someone simply hailing a standard cab on the avenue.
But surely this is where autonomous vehicles save the day, right? If we are designing driverless pogs from scratch, we can just design them like living rooms. We can put in carriage seating where everyone faces each other. We can put in the Toyota swivel seats. We can make the doors 6 feet wide. Why are AV companies just doing that right now?
Because they are immediately hitting the wall of make inoperative exemptions.
Okay, what does that mean?
The National Transportation Safety Board, the NTSB, has thoroughly documented this hurdle. You have to remember that current federal motor vehicle safety standards are predicated entirely on over a century of traditional human-driven vehicle design.
Meaning everything assumes there's a steering wheel.
Exactly. Crash tests evaluate frontal, side, and rear impacts using standard test dummies that are sitting rigidly, facing directly forward, with a steering column right in front of them.
Right, the crash test dummy is always looking at the windshield, waiting for the airbag to deploy from the steering wheel.
Yes, the physics of occupant protection, the seat belts, the crumple zones, the airbag deployment timing are all mathematically calibrated for that specific forward-facing posture. So, if an AV manufacturer wants to build a brilliantly accessible pod, with omnidirectional seating, meaning seats that face inwards, backwards, or swivel dynamically, they have to legally prove that the vehicle is safe in an omnidirectional crash.
Which sounds completely reasonable until you realize.
Until you realize that the federal standards, the testing protocols, and even the biometrics for omnidirectional crash test dummies don't fully exist yet in the regulatory framework.
Oh, wow.
The law strictly prohibits vehicle manufacturers from making standard safety features inoperative. Removing a steering wheel or turning a seat backwards so the standard airbag doesn't protect the occupant in a frontal collision technically renders those safety features inoperative.
So they literally can't build it without breaking the law.
Right. This effectively bans the radical interior redesigns required for true universal design unless the manufacturer applies for and is granted highly restricted temporary exemptions.
Wait, so the very safety regulations that were designed to protect passengers are currently acting as a bureaucratic straitjacket, legally preventing engineers from building the specialized pods that could actually serve everyone safely.
It is a classic example of regulatory lag. We see it a lot with new tech.
It's so frustrating.
The conceptual philosophy of universal design and the rapid advancement of autonomous technology are moving at a velocity that vastly outpaces the bureaucratic speed of federal testing standards.
Okay, but let's play out a hypothetical. Let's say we wave a magic wand. The regulations catch up. We solve the hardware friction. We have a fleet of perfectly designed, universally accessible, omnidirectional autonomous pods roaming the streets. The second we take the human driver out of that vehicle, we are hit with an entirely new, deeply complex wall of friction, aren't we?
We absolutely are, because our society drastically underestimates the multifaceted role of a professional driver. We often reduce the job of a bus driver or a paratransit operator to simply turning a steering wheel and modulating the brake pedal.
When in reality, they do so much more.
Exactly. In the reality of public transport, the driver is a dynamic, problem-solving agent.
The driver is the invisible glue holding the entire fragile system of accessible transit together. Think about the physical mechanics of taking a city bus if you use a mobility device. What actually happens? The driver visually spots you at the stop. The driver manually triggers the pneumatic system to kneel the bus, lowering the front suspension.
Right, they manage the physical hardware.
And the driver deploys the mechanical ramp. If the ramp gets jammed by a piece of gravel, the driver gets out of their seat and physically beagles it loose. Once you are on board, The driver often physically assists in strapping the wheelchair into the securement area.
And beyond the physical tasks, they're also performing continuous cognitive and social labor. They assist with wayfinding, they enforce social order on the bus, and they troubleshoot real-time routing issues.
Yeah, they are the human safety net.
So the research from the Mineta Transportation Institute poses a massive, unresolved question. In an autonomous future, who fulfills that role? If you remove the onboard human operator, you suddenly require flawless, automated ingress and egress.
Which means the robot has to do it perfectly.
Precisely. You need an autonomous vehicle that can auto-dock perfectly flush with the curb down to the millimeter every single time, regardless of weather or debris.
And what happens when a piece of wet trash is blown over the optical sensor of the automatic ramp? Does the computer just throw an error code? Does the whole bus just sit there immobilized while the passengers stare at each other?
This is exactly the operational vulnerability researchers are flagging. To bridge this gap, the industry is exploring the concept of a trained human in the loop.
Like remote control.
Kind of. This could involve remote operators sitting in a command center monitoring dozens of internal vehicle cameras, ready to digitally take over the vehicle to troubleshoot an issue. Other models dangerously suggest relying on the goodwill of educated fellow passengers to physically assist with ramps or securement.
Relying on random passengers to safely operate heavy mechanical restraints. That introduces an absolute nightmare of liability and reliability issues.
Highly problematic.
And we are actually seeing this hardware regression play out right now in the real world with autonomous bus pilots. Our sources draw a brilliant comparison between the standard European low-floor bus and these new experimental AV shuttles.
The European low-floor bus is arguably one of the greatest triumphs of standardized mechanical design in public transit.
How does it work?
By shifting the engine and drivetrain components, they created a cabin floor that is nearly flush with the standard curb height. It allows for level, barrier-free boarding without the need for complex, failure-prone mechanical lifts. It is a seamless, highly efficient experience.
But then you look at the early stage autonomous bus pilots rolling around various test cities, and it is a massive step backward. Because these AV shuttles are essentially in a rolling beta test phase, prioritizing software over hardware, many of them currently lack universal wheelchair ramp access entirely.
It's a real oversight.
So you have this deeply ironic situation where the highly touted transportation of the future is actually forcing passengers with reduced mobility back onto conventional human-driven buses because the robots aren't physically capable of boarding them.
It is a temporary yet painful regression dictated by technological triage. The engineering teams are so overwhelmingly focused on the computational nightmare of ensuring the AI doesn't steer the bus into a pedestrian that the physical accessibility hardware is relegated to version 2.0.
Which is incredibly unfair to the users.
It is. But even if we solve the physical access, we must address cognitive access. Removing the human driver transfers a massive cognitive workload onto the passenger, leading to what researchers call HMI anxiety.
HMI, human-machine interface. I have to admit, reading this section of the research gave me secondhand stress. It is so relatable.
It is a profound psychological barrier. When you remove the human driver, you replace their empathetic contextual understanding with a digital screen, a voice assistant, or a mobile app.
You lose the human grace.
Right. You are forcing the passenger to interface directly with the machine's logic.
To understand this, I want to use an analogy based on the sources because it perfectly captures the feeling. Think about those confusing fast food AI order kiosks that are popping up everywhere. You walk in, you just want a simple cheeseburger.
We've all been there.
But you have to navigate a massive touchscreen with 50 submenus. The interface is slightly lagging. It keeps interrupting you to ask if you want to upgrade your drink or add a promotional item. And meanwhile, there are three impatient people standing in line behind you, glaring at the back of your head. The stress of that minor interaction is real.
That is decision anxiety caused by interface friction.
Right.
Now, scale that cognitive load up to a moving vehicle navigating a busy city.
Oh, man.
Imagine an automated system suddenly prompting an elderly passenger with a complex real-time choice on a screen about rerouting due to construction, or asking them to validate a payment error while the pod is in motion.
That would be overwhelming.
For many demographics, particularly older adults, those with cognitive disabilities, or even tourists who don't speak the native language, that HMI friction is an insurmountable barrier.
And it creates this terrifying level of societal vulnerability. The sources dive into case studies of transit networks in London and Helsinki, which are moving heavily toward digital touchpoint dependency.
Everything's moving to the smartphone.
Yeah. You tap your smartphone to enter the station. You tap it to board the bus. You use an app to map your route. But imagine the sheer existential panic of a dead mobile phone battery when your entire ability to open the pod doors, pay for the ride, and navigate a sprawling city relies entirely on that one piece of consumer electronics.
It ruthlessly exposes the fragility of digital-only infrastructure. If the user's technology fails, or if the cellular network drops, the user is completely physically stranded.
With no one to ask for help.
Exactly. There is no human driver to whom you can explain the situation, no one to read your body language, no one to offer grace or common sense assistance. The machine only understands binary inputs authenticated or denied.
Okay, so we've established the hardware is too rigid, retrofitting is a financial trap, and the digital interfaces cause immense anxiety. But what happens when we take these incredibly complex, software-heavy robot buses and drop them into a brutal, unforgiving, real-world environment? Like, say, a place where the weather drops below freezing.
This is where theoretical engineering violently collides with atmospheric reality. Our sources detail a highly revealing pioneer robotic bus trial conducted in a suburb of Tampere in Finland.
Tampere, Finland. They deploy these autonomous shuttles into the Hervanta suburb, and the engineers immediately smash into the reality that robot buses are unbelievably SW-heavy, software-heavy.
The sheer volume and complexity of the AI code required to safely navigate a vehicle through chaotic, mixed traffic is staggering.
How does it even work?
Well, autonomous vehicles don't see like we do. They rely on sensor fusion. This is the process of continuously melding together massive streams of data from three distinct hardware systems. LiDAR, which uses pulsed lasers to map 3D space, radar, which uses radio waves to detect mass and velocity, and optical cameras, which read color, contrast, and lane markings.
And the AI has to instantly stitch all that data together to form a coherent picture of the world. But here is the terrifying statistic from the research. The NTSB found that in typical high-level automotive code, there are between 20 to 50 errors per 1,000 lines of code.
That is the standard error rate, yes. And we were talking about autonomous systems that run on tens of millions of lines of code.
It's mind-boggling. To explain why this is so difficult, think of sensor fusion like trying to conduct a massive symphony orchestra. The optical cameras are the string section, the radar is the brass, and the LiDAR is the percussion.
That's a very helpful way to visualize the data streams.
If the string section is playing in one time signature, but the percussion section is playing in another, the AI processor has to instantly figure out what the actual melody is. And if it guesses wrong, the bus crashes.
Because the AI doesn't possess human context, it is highly susceptible to context failure. It might perfectly identify a shape, but completely misunderstand its physical properties.
Which brings us to the Mobileye example from the text. Mobileye is a titan in autonomous tech. They were doing a high-profile demonstration for television journalists, and their autonomous car just flat-out ran a red light, blew right through the intersection.
During a live demo.
Wow.
Yeah. The engineers analyzed the data, and it turned out that strong, low-angle sunlight had hit the optical cameras at the exact perfect angle to blind the aperture, or at least wash out the contrast of the red light.
So the camera literally couldn't see the color red.
Right. If a human driver gets glare in their eyes, they drop the sun visor, squint, and tap the brakes. The AI, lacking that context, just assumed the intersection was clear and kept accelerating.
Now take those inherent sensor vulnerabilities and place them in Tampere, Finland, in January.
Oh, that sounds like a nightmare for the sensors.
The environmental friction is devastating to autonomous systems. Heavy snow completely obscures painted lane markings, rendering optical cameras useless. Ice radically alters the physics of braking distance, which the AI struggles to calculate dynamically.
And what about the lasers?
Furthermore, LiDAR lasers reflect off dense falling snowflakes, causing the system to hallucinate solid walls in front of the vehicle, known as phantom obstacles, forcing the bus to violently and abruptly halt.
So the bus is effectively blind, slipping on ice, and constantly slamming on the brakes because it thinks snowflakes are concrete barricades. How do the engineers in Finland possibly fix that?
They quickly realized that the computational power required to solve those variables cannot reside entirely within the vehicle itself. The bus cannot hold all the intelligence. They have to rely on V2X communication, vehicle-to-everything infrastructure.
Vehicles-to-everything. This means the city itself has to become a localized supercomputer.
Precisely. The traffic lights, the road signs, embedded sensors in the asphalt, they all have to continuously broadcast their status and environmental data digitally to the approaching bus.
It's like the bus needs a digital cheat sheet broadcast from the streetlights because its own eyes are covered in snow.
That's exactly what V2X provides.
And beyond the software, there is a brutal logistical reality here. If one of these autonomous shuttles suffers a sensor failure and abruptly halts in a sub-zero Finnish winter, you cannot just tell the passengers to wait an hour for a standard tow truck. The heating systems might fail. The passengers will literally freeze to death.
Exactly. The removal of the onboard driver necessitates the creation of an entirely new, highly responsive layer of operational infrastructure. Municipalities have to build and staff real-time remote monitoring centers.
Like an air traffic control tower for buses.
Yes. They have to employ localized, rapid response recovery teams, human drivers, and specialized rescue vehicles ready to deploy the exact second an AV stalls in extreme weather.
But wait, doesn't that completely destroy the economic argument for autonomous transit? The whole pitch was that cities would save millions of dollars by eliminating driver salaries. But now, you have to hire a room full of remote monitors and a fleet of rapid response rescue drivers on standby?
It heavily shifts the economic burden from onboard labor to back-end infrastructure and cybersecurity. If we connect this to the bigger picture, the sensor fusion vulnerabilities, the weather degradation, the math of software complexity, it leads to a sobering conclusion presented by the Chartered Institution of Highways and Transportation.
Which is what?
We simply cannot drop autonomous vehicles into chaotic mixed traffic with unpredictable human drivers and expect them to function safely in the near term.
So what is the solution? Do we just lock the tech in a lab and wait 20 years?
No, the proposed transitional step is the creation of dedicated driverless spaces.
Dedicated driverless spaces. So you're talking about geofencing the AVs, like an HOV carpool lane, but walled off exclusively for robots?
Conceptually, yes. By physically segregating the AVs into dedicated lanes, or geofencing them within specific, highly mapped urban zones, you drastically reduce the cognitive load on the AI.
You take away the randomness.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You eliminate the most unpredictable variable in the environment, which is the human driver cutting them off or running a stop sign. This radically simplifies the operating environment, ensures baseline public safety, and allows the technology to build public trust during the transition period.
I hear what you're saying about safety, but I have to push back on this. Doesn't geofencing AVs into dedicated, walled-off lanes completely defeat the revolutionary promise of an autonomous vehicle? If we have to spend billions of dollars physically restructuring our cities to build them their own exclusive guideways, aren't we just reinventing the train, but in a wildly less efficient, lower-capacity way?
It is a highly valid critique. It is essentially building a less efficient light rail system. However, engineers argue it is a necessary transitional crutch. The AI needs to accrue billions of miles of real-world data in a semi-controlled environment before it can handle the infinite variables of an unregulated city street.
Okay, assuming we accept that we need these dedicated driverless spaces for the next decade, that brings up a really thorny, deeply political issue. How do city planners actually decide where these new billion-dollar transport networks go? Because if history tells us anything, we are terrible at equitable urban planning.
That is the domain of regional transport planning. And unfortunately, as our Finnish thesis source meticulously reveals, the current computational models we use to plan these routes are deeply fundamentally flawed. They are ignoring the actual humans using the systems.
The data in this thesis is infuriating. The researcher analyzed the ELY centers in Finland. These are the powerful regional authorities responsible for transport planning. And you would assume, in the era of big data, that they are using cutting-edge, real-time analytics to figure out exactly where the community needs transit. But mostly, they are just legally fulfilling statutory zones and responsibilities.
Their planning is dictated by statutory mandates rather than organic human need. For example, the law dictates they must provide specific routing for students to get from rural areas to schools. They also heavily prioritize the infrastructure for the standard 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. commuter rush into the city center.
Which is fantastic if you happen to be a high school student or a white-collar office worker. But what about literally everyone else? The thesis points out a massive systemic failure by these ELY centers to utilize sociodemographic heat maps.
They're looking at the wrong data sets.
Yeah, the planners are literally missing crucial variables from their data sets, variables like age group distribution, income levels, gender-based travel patterns, and the locations of unemployed populations seeking work.
By ignoring those sociodemographic realities, planners create a severe spatial mismatch. The methodology they use to define access is archaic. Planners typically draw simple, static 400-meter or 800-meter buffer zones around a proposed bus stop on a two-dimensional map.
It's just geometry to them.
Right. If a residential area falls within that perfect geometric circle, the planner checks a bureaucratic box and declares, well, that neighborhood is adequately served.
But a circle drawn on a map means absolutely nothing in the physical world, especially in rural or suburban areas. That 800-meter line might look fine on paper, but in reality, it might require a 75-year-old woman to walk across a six-lane highway with no crosswalk or trudge through a snow-covered field.
The physical terrain matters.
Exactly. The elderly frequently fall just outside these rigid buffer zones, completely cutting them off from independent access to healthcare, groceries, or social connection.
And we must emphasize that this reliance on flawed modeling is not just a finished problem. The University of Toronto's Transportation Research Institute provided devastating analysis of standard travel demand models used in North America, specifically dismantling the widely used TASHA models.
Oh man, the TASHA models. This is where the research gets incredibly dense and nerdy, but it is so important to understand because it dictates how billions of our tax dollars are spent.
It's the hidden engine of city planning.
Yeah. TASHA stands for Travel Activity Scheduler for Household Agents. It is the complex software architecture that major cities use to predict traffic flow and justify new transit lines. But the University of Toronto researchers completely eviscerate it. They describe these traditional models as computationally inefficient, hardwired, and functioning like a black box.
The fundamental mathematical flaw lies in how these models conceptualize human behavior. Traditional models look at trips in isolation. They map a simple, linear trajectory from point A to point B.
Like home to work and work to home.
Yes. The model calculates the volume of people moving from home to the office in the morning and from the office back home in the evening.
But humans do not travel like robots on a track. We engage in what the researchers brilliantly call tour interactions. Think about your normal Tuesday morning. You don't just magically teleport from home to your desk.
No, life is way more complicated than that.
Right. You leave your house, you drive to drop the kids off at school, then you detour to a drive-thru for coffee, then you finally go to the office. On the way home, you stop at the grocery store, maybe pick up dry cleaning, and then return home. That is a chained tour of interactions.
Exactly. It is a deeply complex, interdependent chain of spatial activities. But because hard-coding millions of those microscopic, unpredictable human variables, like deciding to stop for coffee because it's raining, makes the algorithms overwhelmingly dense, the traditional planning software simply ignores that reality to save computational power.
It just pretends it doesn't happen.
Yes. It restricts the potential for complex tours, ignores the specific duration people spend at secondary stops, and optimizes the transit network for a simplified, linear version of reality that doesn't actually exist.
So, if I'm hearing you correctly, what this all means is that local governments are currently pouring billions of dollars into pouring concrete, laying tracks, and plotting bus routes based on a mathematical map of human behavior that is completely fundamentally inaccurate.
In many structural ways, yes. We are optimizing massive infrastructure for ghost patterns. And this is exactly where the integration of autonomous vehicles could offer a massive structural paradigm shift, moving us away from these flawed static models through the implementation of demand response scheduling.
Demand response scheduling, this is essentially the death of the fixed bus route, isn't it?
It is the evolution of transit from a rigid static infrastructure into a fluid on-demand service. Currently, a city runs a massive 40-foot bus on a fixed loop every hour, burning fuel, regardless of whether it is completely empty or packed.
Forcing citizens to bend their lives around an arbitrary printed timetable.
Exactly. With an autonomous fleet utilizing demand response scheduling, the routing becomes entirely dynamic, driven by real-time data.
So instead of you walking 800 meters to wait in the snow for a bus that might be late, the system's algorithm looks at the actual sociodemographic heat map of human need in that exact moment. The pod comes directly to you.
It adapts to the user.
Right. It learns the organic patterns, it knows that Mrs. Smith needs a ride to the pharmacy every Tuesday at 10 a.m., and it dynamically adjusts its route to seamlessly incorporate her trip without disrupting the broader network flow.
It drastically reduces wasted vehicle miles and provides granular equity to those stranded outside the traditional buffer zones. And once we synthesize all of this, once we mandate universal design in the hardware, solve the sensor fusion software friction, and deploy fluid demand response planning, we unlock something profoundly transformative.
Which brings us to the psychology of it all.
Yes. Autonomous vehicles won't just change how we commute. They will completely revolutionize our psychological relationship with distance and time.
This is undoubtedly my favorite part of the research pile. We have this fascinating study from Arkansas University that specifically analyzes long-distance travel behavior, looking at how Level 4 and Level 5 fully autonomous vehicles will rewrite the rules for trips over 100 miles.
They categorize travelers into two distinct psychological buckets, right?
Yeah, business travelers and pleasure travelers.
The business case presents the most immediate and disruptive psychological unlock, primarily because it alters the economic value of time. Currently, a 300-mile regional business trip is an exhausting logistical puzzle.
It's an all-day affair.
It involves booking an expensive regional flight, traveling to the airport, enduring security lines, waiting at the gate, flying, renting a car at the destination, and checking into a hotel overnight.
It's what the researchers call the mode change in convenience. Every single time you switch from a taxi to a plane to a rental car, you bleed time, money, and cognitive energy. But imagine the scenario with a fully autonomous, universally designed vehicle.
It's a completely different paradigm.
The executive simply finishes dinner at home, gets into their autonomous pod at 10 p.m. The interior of the car is no longer a cockpit. It is essentially a mobile apartment. They lie down in a proper, ergonomically designed bed. The car travels 300 miles silently through the night. The executive sleeps 8 hours and wakes up at 7 a.m., showered and refreshed, parked directly outside the lobby of their morning meeting.
It effectively recovers lost human capital. Furthermore, it completely eliminates the regional hotel industry and shorehaul airlines from the equation. The vehicle absorbs the function of both transit and accommodation.
It's brilliant, but the data point that really caught me off guard was the divergence between how business travelers and family or pleasure travelers intend to use these vehicles. The data shows business travelers absolutely prefer to travel at night. They want to sleep through the commute, completely commodify the travel time, and save their waiting daylight hours for productive work.
Logically, one would assume families embarking on a long vacation would share that preference. You load the kids into the AV at midnight, let them sleep, and wake up at Disney World.
That sounds ideal to me.
But the Arkansas study revealed a fascinating psychological twist. Pleasure travelers overwhelmingly, specifically, prefer daytime travel in autonomous vehicles.
Which seems counterintuitive until you unpack the psychology. Why do they want to travel during the day?
It fundamentally comes down to the psychology of trust and the human need for situational awareness. The survey data strongly indicated that people have a deep-seated instinctual nervousness about trusting an invisible AI to navigate them through the dark.
So it's about fear.
Essentially, yes. They want the sensory reassurance of daytime. They want to be able to look out the windows. They want to be awake to visually monitor the environment and the system's decisions, even if they have absolutely no physical controls to intervene.
That is such a deeply human quirk. It's the ultimate expression of, well, I trust the multi-billion-dollar robot to drive my family, but I'm going to keep my eyes wide open and stare at the road just in case. It's an illusion of control.
It is.
Plus, the study noted a more positive reason. Families actually want to enjoy the travel time. With AVs, the interior of the car transforms from a claustrophobic penalty box into a moving living room. You can sit around a table, play board games, watch a movie together, or just read a book while looking at the scenery.
The journey ceases to be a miserable chore to endure and becomes an actual part of the vacation experience.
And this profound shift in how humans spend their waking time inside vehicles will spawn an entirely new parallel economic ecosystem. Urban planners and economists call this the emergence of the experiential side quest.
The experiential side quest. I absolutely love this concept because right now the entire architecture of our highway economy is built around biological and mechanical necessity.
Think about all those massive rest stops.
Right. We have massive infrastructure dedicated to gas stations, fast food drive-thrus, and cheap motels. You stop your car because you either have to refuel the machine or you have to refuel and rest the exhausted human driver.
But if the vehicle is fully electric and autonomous, and the passengers are happily engaged in a movie, sleeping, or working, the traditional desperate roadside stop becomes completely obsolete.
They won't need to stop for a break.
Exactly. Instead, we will see the rise of new spatial and service loops designed around desire rather than necessity.
So what does that look like?
Well, you'll have localized, automated fleet maintenance hubs off the highways where empty pods go to rapid charge and clean themselves. But for the passengers inside, the routing AI will offer algorithmic, curated detours.
Oh, like suggesting activities along the way.
Yeah. Imagine you're on a mundane family road trip and a gentle notification pops up on the windshield screen. You are currently 10 minutes away from a highly rated scenic strawberry picking farm. Because of optimal traffic routing ahead, adding this 45-minute stop to stretch your legs will only delay your final arrival time by 20 minutes. Would you like the pod to detour?
That is amazing. It transitions the fundamental nature of travel from a linear, stressful A to B chore into a curated, fluid, on-demand experience. The vehicle becomes an active participant in designing your day.
It is truly mind-blowing to think about the ripple effects of this technology. Okay, we have covered a massive amount of ground today. Let's do a quick, cohesive recap of the journey.
We began by redefining the very concept of accessibility, moving away from the legal minimums of ADA compliance toward the inclusive brilliance of universal design.
We highlighted how Toyota's Ergo Index and the mechanical ingenuity of the port's auto-access swivel seats proved that designing for the margins ultimately benefits everyone.
We then explored the painful, expensive reality of the retrofitting trap. We looked at how taking a static, factory-standard van and hacking it apart for a $60,000 aftermarket wheelchair ramp ruins the vehicle's structural integrity.
Yeah, leading to worn-out tires and horrifying scenarios where passengers are forced to enter taxis from the rear directly into active Manhattan traffic. We also expose how current federal crash test standards actually legally block the omnidirectional seating designs we desperately need.
We examine the severe friction of removing the human driver. We lose not just their physical assistance with ramps and restraints, but we introduce profound HMI anxiety.
We force vulnerable passengers to navigate confusing digital interfaces and expose them to the existential dread of being completely stranded by a dead smartphone battery in cities that rely entirely on digital touchpoints.
Then we travel to the freezing winters of Tampere, Finland, to understand the sheer software terror of sensor fusion. We learned how LiDAR systems hallucinate phantom obstacles in the snow and how AI cameras can be blinded by simple sun glare.
Proving that we might need V2X communication and walled-off dedicated driverless spaces just to survive the technological transition period.
We critiqued the fundamentally flawed black box regional planning algorithms, like the Tasha models, which ignore complex human behavior and sociodemographic realities.
We discussed how static 400-meter buffer zones leave rural populations stranded and how demand response scheduling can finally fix that spatial mismatch.
And finally, we envisioned a radically different future where autonomous vehicles become mobile hotel rooms, unlocking hyper-efficient night travel for business executives and generating algorithmic side quests for families who prefer to keep their eyes open during the day.
It represents a profound structural shift in how humanity interacts with physical space, time, and each other.
It really does.
Which brings me to a final, slightly mind-bending, provocative thought for you to chew on while you finish your walk. We've spent this entire time talking about how the physical architecture of cars will change to become our mobile living rooms, our bedrooms, our offices.
The car is a destination.
Right. But if your car successfully evolves into your house on wheels, how will the physical architecture of your actual house in your city inevitably change? Think about it.
Oh, that's a wild thought.
If you can comfortably and cheaply commute 200 miles while sleeping deeply in your pod, do we even need hyper-expensive, high-density city centers anymore? Will the suburbs sprawl for hundreds of miles? And bringing it even closer to home, does your future house even need a driveway or a garage if you don't own the car? And the autonomous pod just drops you at the front door and silently rolls away to a fleet hub.
It is a question that challenges the very foundation of modern urban design and personal property.
Definitely something to ponder as you look at those empty driveways and concrete curbs you're walking past right now. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Enjoy the rest of your walk.